Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeremiah Gorka, a writer and public policy analyst who specializes in politics and policy of U.S. national and homeland security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the United States military. He was the lead author of The Mujahideen Ehaq, in Iraq, a Policy Conundrum. He was also a member of a research team that helped to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and a staffer on the Congressionally Mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremiah Gorka.
Thanks, Ian. Really glad to be back.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, clearly under an enormous amount of lobbying pressure, decided to remove the MEK from the State Department's list of designated terrorist organizations. It's extraordinary when you look at the list of national security luminaries who weighed on behalf of the MEK, two former CIA directors, James Woolsey and Porter Goss, former head of this FBI, Louis Freeh, former head of Homeland Security under Bush, Tom Ridge, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, President Obama's first National Security Advisor, General James Jones, and then, of course, the journalists who were paid a lot of money, including Carl Bernstein of the Watergate fame and Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and on and on and on, Ed Rendell, Howard Dean. It's been an amazing public relations effort. So where's all this money coming from that are buying up our politicians?
Well, that's the big question, and it'll be interesting to see whether the Treasury Department bothers to continue its investigation after the delisting decision goes through. It'll take a little while for it to fully process. But it's the question everyone's wondering. I know when I was visiting Camp Ashraf, which is Mujahideen Ehaq's camp in Iraq in 2007, I heard all sorts of great rumors. I wasn't sure how much of it to believe, but it was interesting that when the group's leader, Mariam Rajavi, was arrested in 2003 in Paris, the police found several million dollars worth of bonds and other types of financial instruments at her Paris headquarters. Saddam Hussein gave them a lot of money back during the Iran-Iraq War and afterwards. It's exact quantities. I don't know. They have huge access to cash, and there are certainly some wealthy businessmen who are the ones who are at least named as the people actually funding these the lobbyists and officials. They some call them front groups.
Well, years ago, a long time ago, actually, they tried to win me over with glossy propaganda and bribes, etc. So they're fairly ubiquitous. But what worries me about this decision on the part of Secretary Clinton is that it's likely to open the door for congressional funding of the MEK to conduct terrorist attacks inside of Iran, which is what they've been doing. There's a whole slew of bills waiting, right, to fund terrorists. We funded Jandala there for a while until it backfired on the Baluchistan side of Iran. So is that your expectation?
Pretty much. It's my expectation and worry. There are far too many people who seem to think that the MEK would be some type of useful ally in Iran, whether it's to conduct violent activities or to provide intelligence or to be some type of democratic organization to promote democracy from within. It's none of those things. It's not a democratic organization. It is a cult group. And if people think it's a good idea to fund a group like this to do acts of violence, I think that's just a mistake, and I worry that we'll end up seeing just a repeat of Ahmed Shalabi with Iraq.
So, Jeremiah Gorka, you went to Camp Ashraf, which is on the border between Iraq and Iran, and just to get a little bit of a brief history. The MEK came out after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. They basically lost out to the Ayatollah, and they've been waging a kind of low-intensity war against the theocratic regime in Tehran. And then during the Iran-Iraq War, they sided with Saddam Hussein, who gave them safe harbor at this Camp Ashraf. And then when the United States invaded Iraq, they were disarmed. And then there's been a lot of pressure to get them moved out of Camp Ashraf to Camp Liberty, where apparently most of them have shown up. And the UN is now stuck figuring out what the hell they're going to do with these people. Is that a brief history?
That's pretty much it. They did wage violence against the Shah, and then when they were pushed out during the effort to create the new government after the revolution, they fought violently against the new Islamic Republic, who suppressed the MEK violently back. They went into exile, joined forces with Saddam during the Iran-Iraq War, and in the process lost all of their support in Iran. And so the issue of resettlement is a big one now, because the decision to fight on behalf of Saddam not only ruined their support in Iran, but it's paid negative dividends now, because they worked with the Kurdish with Saddam on behalf. Let me clarify this. They are widely perceived to have fought on behalf of Saddam to suppress the Kurdish and Shia uprisings that followed the 1991 Gulf War. And for that, the majority of the Iraqi population loathes the MEK. Plus, you add the fact that the government of Iraq is close with the government of Iran, which loathes the MEK. And so Iraq, since every government in Iraq since 2003, has been very clear that they want the MEK out. The issue is that they are all Iranian citizens. The only place for them to go would be Iran, but it is illegal to be a member of the MEK in Iran. It's a crime there. Iran has brought an amnesty towards the rank-and-file members of the MEK, should they want to come home and be willing to cut their ties with the group. And some people in the MEK have done that. They've cut ties and gone home. But there are these 3,000-odd folks in who were at Camp Ashraf still. In order to get a resettlement process, to find some other third country for them to go to, UN and company were trying to force the MEK to go to Camp Liberty, just outside of Baghdad, to go through a resettlement process. And the MEK is a very difficult group to work with, and the State Department landed on the delisting as a carrot that would work, and it does seem that was a big player in the decision to take them off the list. Though certainly the lobbying that you mentioned already would have created a political atmosphere in which Secretary Clinton would have felt that was a politically safe move.
Yeah, but surely what's going on here is the fact that the MEK are in effect, a terrorist asset that can be used inside of Iran. The Israelis have used them, apparently, to provide so-called intelligence on Iran's nuclear program, which is suspect in itself. They've supposedly been also involved in the assassinations of, or setting up, or perhaps even conducting the assassinations of a number of Iranian scientists, etc. I find it inescapable to assume that what we're talking about here is an asset which is, you know, could seriously create blowback and it could backfire. But that's my assumption. We're not helping these people out for any other reason, are we?
Well, it's hard to disaggregate all of this, and I'm currently trying to finish writing a piece for the American Prospect that kind of breaks it all down as I see it. I think there are lots of people in the government, in the military and in the civilian government, who see the MEK as a potential asset, a useful proxy, or at the least like bullet catchers, which is kind of a cold-blooded way of thinking about it. There are others who think that the MNK is absolutely useless, that their intelligence that they provide is either no good or stuff that we already knew, who think that they are, or in fact know that they are a cult group that is untrustworthy and not worth using. Even during the Bush administration, people were of mixed opinions, and it sort of depended on who was actually making decisions, and even among decision makers, people were split on it. So this is why I have a hard time thinking that this is sort of a clear decision along those lines. Some people think they're useful, and some people don't. The State Department has, for years, really wanted the MEK issue off of their plate. So there's a sort of bureaucratic element of this that is, I think, often kind of missed. But I know when I was interviewing State Department officials, when I was at the RAND Corporation and did the research for my RAND report, it was sort of an atmospheric issue. The State Department wanted this off of their plate, and so this is probably a means of doing that. And then there are a couple other things that are factors. One is that the State Department had only about another week to make its decision to keep the MNK on the list or remove it before a federal court was going to remove it automatically on its own. So there was a timing pressure. And there is an interesting legal issue to the extent that the law was determinative here. The Foreign Terrorist Organization law, which is the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, it lays out requirements for what counts as a group that could be listed as a foreign terrorist organization. And one of the interesting things about it is that it does allow a group to try to get off of the list if it can show that circumstances have changed. Mm-hmm. And
Well, we're pretty much out of time.
Sorry.
But thank you so much for joining us, Jeremiah. And sharing your first-hand experience with the MEK.
Sure. Thanks so much, Ian, for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeremiah Gorka, writer and public policy analyst who specializes in the politics and policy of U.S. national and homeland security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the U.S. military. He was a lead author of the Mujahideen Haq in Iraq, a policy conundrum. He was also a member of the research team that helped end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the congressionally mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Bibi Netanyahu has already crossed a couple of red lines interfering in U.S. domestic politics as he tries to drag the U.S. into another unnecessary war.
Now there's a woman on my block, just sitting, facing the hills, saying, who's gonna take away? Who's gonna take away? Who's gonna take away? Now he's hell-bent for destruction.